This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
It's great to be here. And I went to the water exhibition and I wandered through it and I thought, you know, it's a fascinating exhibition and it tells you so much about water and it asks quite a lot of questions. And some of them don't have answers. Some of them don't have easy answers. And one of them is, you know, how do we change our attitude to water? How do we inculcate respect into the way we look at water? And, you know, one of the things that I think we need to think about, the exhibition raised that in my mind again, is things like the word management and resource. Management and resource imply that we have control, that we can control, that we're able to control, that we're responsible enough to control. And yet, you know, one of the films in the exhibition shows a tsunami. If you're thinking about trying to control water, you should have a look at a tsunami and say, look, you know, basically this thing is bigger than all of us. And we need to think about water, I believe, in the way that Indigenous people think about water, which is in a totally different perspective. And so what I'm here today to show you is a glimpse of the perspective that Indigenous people around the world have about water. And, you know, many people in the world believe that water is God. That water is actually God, not that God controls the water. You know, when they pray for rain, they pray to the clouds to send the rain. They don't pray for some God up there to organise the rain or an angel to organise the rain. And, you know, when you think about it, that's all you can see up there is the clouds. And maybe water is God, and maybe we've been deluded for thousands of years. Anyway, this is what some people believe, and I'll put their point of view in due course. I'd like to just start with a little DVD of images from different cultures and different ideas that sum up what we'll be talking about or that might prepare you. And the music behind this is made by slapping buckets of water. They're African water drums, but it's just hitting, hands hitting water. A water music and the DVD, thank you. So these are some of the symbols and some of the images of water that we and other cultures have evolved over the centuries. Now this drop of water that we've been looking at, this drop of water that contains the history of the universe and the history of the world. Where did the world come from? The world came from a spinning orb of something or other, a plasma in the universe somewhere that became surrounded by water. I don't know where the water came from. But essentially it was that water that cooled the earth and that water that shaped the earth and that water that became an enormous sea that covered the earth. And within that sea was the germ of every living thing that would emerge from it, including us. You know, if that water contained within itself everything, and it must have because we all came from it, everything emerged from the water, every life form. And so the life forms that we are may have been, and were likely to have been, contained within that framework. So I like to show you, before we get into some of that stuff, I'd like to show you what some of the structure of water looks like. Like water, for instance, has, if we look at communication, water is constantly communicating, and it communicates by vibration, it communicates by form, it communicates by movement. And these movements and forms are universal forms. Like, what happens when you drop a stone into a pond? You get a series of concentric ripples. And so this form, this concentric form, is how we view the universe. It's how astronomers view the movement of the stars. It's how, in ancient times in Egypt, the onion was considered one of the most sacred vegetables and fruits because it encapsulated the form. When you cut an onion across, it's the concentric circle radiating from the centre. The meaning from that, by the way, that many people took in ancient times was that God was the central point, the creative force was the central point, and the entire universe radiated from that central point. So the concentric circles made by dropping a stone in a pond give you at once one version of water's strangeness, that how water has influenced our thinking, how water has shaped our concepts of art and astrology and astronomy. When you look inside water, you find that it has a six-fold structure. If you're at the exhibition, you'll find that there's a big block of ice, and beside the big block of ice, it shows you what happens when water freezes. And it shows that the molecules that connect with each other have six connections. They're hexagonal. Water has an hexagonal form. The Chinese discovered this 3,000 years ago by looking at snow crystals. And they said, look, if water has this six-sided form when it freezes, then its number must be six. So they were saying the number of water is six. Remember that when you're looking at images of water. So this is a snowflake. Snowflakes are extraordinary things because they constantly vary, but they remain in that six-fold form. There was a guy who photographed snowflakes for years and years and years. He was totally obsessed with snowflakes, and he's built a whole camera setup, and he photographed thousands and thousands and thousands of snowflakes, and he found none were the same, but they all had the six-fold form. And so if you look at these, they're extraordinary artworks. I regard them as water's artworks, water's creativity at work. If you look inside the structure of water, you see the six emerges again. This is inside a molecule of water, a photograph. And you see, again, the six-sided forms. And when you go to, again, this snowflake is a 12 because it's two sixes superimposed. It's two six forms superimposed on one another. And if you vibrate sound through water, you get this form, which is, again, two sixes superimposed on each other. I'm not getting obsessive about sixes and numbers here, but I'm just simply saying that whatever you do, whether you vibrate it, whether you put it in a under a microscope, no matter what sort of methodology you choose to examine water, the six-fold form remains constant. Even when you boil water, if you boil water and you put the fragments of metal on top, this has fine metal dust, and the boiling water actually forms hexagonal. So the hexagon form, again, contains. Now, Indigenous people, nobody told them about the six-fold form, but this is a Navajo sand painting of cloud people. And if you count the number of all these little triangles, they're all sixes. They chose six. So you never know whether six was an accident when you're looking at... I count the numbers whenever I see people doing artworks in Indigenous cultures of water. I look at the numbers that they're using to indicate. And it's just interesting that the cloud people... These are cloud people looking out from behind all those triangles. So what's the gender of water? This is the other thing. You know, if water is a deity, if water might be a god, if water was a god, what would its gender be? And it seems that the consensus is that water is female. Probably the reason why water ought to be female is because if we all came out of this ocean, if this creative ocean was the energy that made us all, then surely it's femaleness, its mother. People, primitive people, early people, indigenous people, I don't know what you want to call them, but the earliest people that we know who expressed themselves in art expressed this idea of water being the mother. And so constantly this image reappears in sculpture, in early cave paintings. This is an African cave painting of supplications for rain and the rain goddess sending rain 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. Even in medieval times, even in Christian times, this is from an illuminated manuscript, and this is Venus, the goddess Venus, in a creek, and here's all these naked people getting ready to plunge in, and there's an old guy who's the blacksmith, the sacred holy blacksmith, who someone said looked a bit like me, and then there's an archer up the top. So there's lots of archers in this film, but in this photograph. But what I'm saying is the goddess survived even in this little Christian illuminated manuscript. People snuck in the belief that there was some divinity associated with water. And maybe there were mermaids. You know, mermaids go back a long way. Mermaids go back 3,000 to 4,000 years. The idea that there are real mermaids, the idea that mermaids might exist, has stimulated the imagination of artists everywhere. This is a Balinese mermaid angel. Mermaid angels combine, they're called apsaras in Indian mythology. The apsara is the angel of the air and the water, the combination of air and water. And of course we have lots and lots of images and ideas of the sea producing these seductive women who tempt men to their doom, which is basically a product of the Christian church around the 13th, 14th century, the idea of that the sea was evil, that nature was evil, that things were in nature were there to tempt you, that they were there to destroy you or lead you to your destruction. And that idea permeated, gave the mermaid story a different twist to what it had in earlier times. You know, this is, the mermaids were always trying to drag men down. They were always trying to take them home and mate with them. And of course, when they did mate with them, they produced babies, you know. And these babies, theoretically, became part of the whole story again. The idea that somehow humans were able to mate with these fish women and produce progeny. Now, this started a long while ago. This is a Babylonian image of a fish goddess. A mermaid, if you like. She has a tail rather like a flathead. This is about 4,000 years old and in the British Museum. And so, you know, the idea of the mermaid grew out of the concept of the fish goddess and the fish gods. And the idea of the fish gods was essentially a way of worshipping water, the way that many cultures have a symbol that they worship instead of the thing itself. You're talking about an element. If you wanted to worship water, you could take the fish as the symbol of water. And this is a Babylonian seal of the two priests, fish priests in fish outfits, worshipping basically what they're doing is watering the tree of life. But it's thought that the actual helmets they're wearing became the mitres of Christian bishops. You'll remember that the original symbol of Christ was not the cross, but the fish. You know, the cross became the symbol of the Christian church quite late in the era. But the earliest Christians used the fish as their symbol. And it's really interesting that that fish symbol came from very ancient times to represent God forms. So fish worship's pretty old. In Japan, they have these fabulous pools where people go for the fish's blessing. And you toss a little bit of fish food in, and these millions of fish in multiple colours appear. And this is a big sort of fertility symbol, for a fertility rite, if you like, for young Japanese couples. They go there and feed the fish, and this is the symbol of fertility and the hope that they'll be blessed with children. Islam took a much more different view of the fish story. You know, the fish was kind of the malevolent. Again, the sea was the source of malevolent monsters and malevolent beings that gave people a hard time. In Asia, the dragon was one of the avatars of water, so that dragons, this is a famous temple in Kyoto, and the spring in this temple has been running for thousands of years, but it was only discovered about 600 years ago. And the Japanese believe that it contains the seeds of knowledge, that this is the water of knowledge, that if you drink this water, your capacity to learn will be improved. And so consequently, lots and lots of people queue up to drink this water at many different sources. Now, you know, sometimes we have water contained around us in religious forms that we don't recognise, like this is the pool of remembrance outside the war memorial in Sydney. And we have pools of remembrance and all over the place, various war memorials. It's quite interesting that the word memory derives from the ancient Hebrew mem, and mem is a symbol that looks like that. It looks like the way rivers flow. That's the way mem is written. But mem means mother and water. So the earliest memory was this idea of water and mother. And it's fascinating that we put these pools to remember. And what else does water do? What else do these pools do? They reflect. And water reflects to us what we do to the earth. Water simply, it, you know, people talk about how we're going to change things and how we're going to improve things, but the water doesn't lie. The water tells us what's happening. And the water is not by nature destructive. The water is not trying to poison us. It's simply showing us, giving us back our own pollution, giving us back our own poisons. When we start to realise that water perhaps is simply reflecting the way that we treat it, we might treat it differently. Like, this is one of the problems of the Ganges in India. I mean, the Ganges is a holy river. It's been worshipped for thousands of years. Even emperors as far away as Persia used to send people for Ganges water. The emperors of Persia and Iran and that sort of area drank only Ganges water because they believed that it was the holy water of life. It didn't prolong their lives necessarily, but they believed so. The problem with the Ganges is that it's getting increasingly polluted, of course, by industrial waste. But previous to that, it was still, because it had all these cities along it, it had masses and masses of human waste before industry started. And nobody could work out why you could drink Ganges water when lots of human waste went into it. And they found, after extensive analysis, that it had a very low level of radioactivity that was sufficient to negate the bacteria that was being excreted into it. The excretion and all the rubbish that went into it was negated or neutralised by the action of this low level of radioactivity. But of course that doesn't work when you get into factories. It doesn't work for industrial waste. Nonetheless, people still go to the Ganges to pray. They go to the Ganges because they believe that they're immersing themselves in the liquid essence of a god, of a deity, of a goddess, Mother Ganga. And there are other places in the world where people treat things differently. I mean, you know, the Japanese have these fantastic places where you have springs that you can write down your troubles and put them in, they dissolve. I mean, how good a psychotherapy is that? And the Japanese have been doing this for hundreds of years because they believe that water absorbs our troubles, that when we go and sit beside a stream, when we go and sit beside a lake or sit beside the sea and forget about thinking and just be with that. And this is how we actually, I think, develop relationships with water. I mean, I think most people that I talk to who haven't had much to do with water, they have particular feeling about a waterfall, or they have particular feeling about a hot spring or a cold spring or whatever. But it doesn't matter what manifestation of water you relate to. The thing is to sit beside it and be still, because in that stillness, things happen. And of course, the wishing well is one of the oldest, you know, Celtic ideas, where essentially you used to throw offerings into the wishing well, and those offerings were in order that your wish might be granted, in order that something might happen, in order that your marriage might be happy. So the wishing well is one of those ancient survivals of water worship, which you don't see very often anymore. This is Lake Manasarovar in Tibet. Lake Manasarovar is one of the great sacred lakes of the world. It's sacred to four different religions, and people, millions of people, travel there every year to spend time around the border of Lake Manasarovar. And I think, you know, our attitudes are what I think, you know, spirit is in the eye of the beholder in many respects. How we see the thing, how we relate to it, what reverence we bring to our relationship with that is what gives us then back the essence. Bali is a particularly, because it's a Hindu culture, particularly a water worshipping culture, but this is a very, very special spring, and this temple is daily inundated with ritual offerings. Not necessarily asking for things. People aren't necessarily asking for things. They're simply according reverence to the water. Something we could learn a lot more about. In Muslim culture, as in many other religions, water is a purifying agent. We see water not just as a purifying agent in a physical sense, but a purifying agent in a spiritual sense. And so we have, you know, all sorts of ideas about baptism. Now, the voodoo religion, which is prominent in Haiti and West Africa, I mean, it came from West Africa, believes in a goddess called Mummy Water. And Mummy Water manifests herself in many forms. And one of them is this incredible waterfall outside in the mountains in Haiti called the Santo de Eau. And every year there's a pilgrimage to the Santo de Eau where people bathe in the holy water. From nuns to voodoo people, Christians also regard the Santo de Eau as a holy place. And they all come together, which is kind of strange. This is another sort of Christian baptism. This is in Russia. You know, so I think, you know, when we go back and we look at how other people might more flamboyantly worship water, and we look at how perhaps how Christians see their relationship with water, we can see some of the differences that emerge. Because I think there's a whole thing about joy, you know. I think we need, perhaps even in the water exhibition that's down there, I don't see a great deal of joy. I'd like to see more infectious enthusiasm rather than the stillness that the photograph imposes. But baptism is almost a universal idea. It isn't a particularly Christian idea. And I noticed when the missionaries first came to South America, to the Aztecs, when they came back in 1650, whenever, 1670, they noticed that the Aztecs had a totally similar ritual, baptismal ritual, to the Christians, and they actually thought that a Christian missionary had been there and taught them. But no, it was part of their ancient tradition. And so the idea of cleansing, what the Aztecs were saying was, we're cleansing the baby of its any impurities that it may bring from its parents and any spiritual impurities it may have, so that it will start its life afresh and anew. And of course, this is a hot lake in New Zealand. When we go to these places and sit for a while in their waters, we can absorb so much of their energy, so much of their peace, so much of their essence. And it requires simply our stillness in that place. Now, one of the things that I suddenly realised is that I don't have a clock and I have absolutely no idea of the time, and therefore I haven't timed my talk, but I hope you'll forgive me. Springs. I mean, there are many manifestations of water which people worship, and one of the things that people have worshipped since the beginning of time is springs, because springs are a kind of miraculous thing. They just come up out of the ground. This spring is the beginning of a river. It actually becomes and is the origin of the water of a vast river, and it all comes from this one point, all day, every day, for 5,000-6,000 years. We don't know, maybe longer. These millions of gallons are pouring out every day. That's kind of a miracle. We don't know where that water comes from even. It's very, very old. And it pours into this temple. There are 36 different channels there. Each one of the channels in this temple is supposed to have a different meaning and a different purpose. So you bathe in these channels for fertility, you bathe for health, you bathe for the God's blessing, whatever. This temple itself is 1,000 years old. It keeps being rebuilt. They rebuild it every now and then because things deteriorate in Bali, but it's always rebuilt on the same place and for the same purpose. And so the worship of springs, I think, is quite a fascinating thing. And I spent quite a time there. I go back to this place because I regard it as one of the great holy places of water in our near vicinity, where one can go and be with that. Another place that worships water is Japan. The Japanese are very pragmatic. They're very great business people. They think very pragmatically like us. But when it comes to water, the Japanese believe in the divine nature, if you like, of hot springs in particular, of water in general, but of hot springs in particular. And we spent quite a bit of time travelling through the hot springs of Japan and meeting people and actually being with that sense of reverence that even our most hard-nosed Toyota executive brings to a hot spring. They do business in hot springs because they believe that hot springs bring us all down to the same level and we're all naked in there. The Japanese don't believe that. They think wearing bathing suits is a really crazy idea and they don't understand why we do it. So they carry these little towels to hide their genitals, but they put them on their heads most of the time. It's very wise. They also, by the way, talking about towels, it's a really interesting thing that one of the most wasteful things... Well, I just wanted to go backwards. One of the most wasteful things we do is we have these enormous thick towels. The Japanese are at total loss to understand why we carry these enormous towels, because all you need is a tiny thin towel to just get, and you keep wringing it out. And Japanese do not use, they might have them in their five-star hotels, but when you think about, you know, we're talking about conserving water, we're talking about how our lifestyle is water hungry. The actual use of towels in the West and the amount of water it takes to wash towels and the amount of energy it takes to dry them, etc., 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 if we return to something as simple as the Japanese towel, it would save us millions and millions and millions of gallons of water every year. So looking at other cultures is often quite... You can learn things. You can learn things that may be useful to you. This is a very primitive spring in New Zealand which has the reputation of helping people with eye problems. It's part of a Maori sacred area and there are a whole series of springs there. And they're very simple. They're very primitive. They're very hot and the water is quite extraordinary. The other thing about water is healing, relaxation, and healing generally. I mean, there are waters in Japan that are reputed to heal all sorts of things, including there's one spring where people go with terminal illnesses, particularly terminal cancers. The water is incredibly hot. It's around 45 degrees, and it's unbelievably hot. You can only tolerate this water for 3 minutes, and then you're likely to die. I experience this. It's frightening. Because you're actually going into boiling water and you can do it, but you can't do it for terribly long. What happens when you come out of that is the endorphins in your body release all this energy and you feel incredibly energized. I thought I'd feel exhausted. No, I wanted to go out and party. So hot springs have really surprising effects on the body. Now, how that affects someone with a terminal illness, I don't know, but this spring has been operating like that for 400 years, and they will only take people. You have to have a doctor's certificate saying you're terminally ill before they will actually let you into the mainspring bar. They don't actually let ordinary people in at all. So I think there are medical questions that we haven't really analysed or looked at very closely about water's capacity to heal. But one thing that's obvious to us is how water can relax us. You know, and one of the things the Japanese do, they love making these waterfalls. So they pipe their hot springs through these very high pipes. And then everyone, nowadays they use Woolworths shopping bags on their heads. You know, so all these people sit around with shopping bags on their heads to protect their hairstyles. And they get this fantastic massage from this hot water. So it's a hot water massage that you move about under and you do all the parts of your body that you feel appropriate. And it is absolutely fantastic. It doesn't cost anything and you can stay there as long as you like. And it's a fantastic... I mean, I go under cold waterfalls like this one. You know, I'm lucky in that I'm in proximity to places where water falls and I can sit under some of these and get fantastic back massages. And other people really like, in Japan particularly, they have found hot springs in very beautiful places, in caves and remote mountaintops and by the sea, and they kind of build their spas around that. And every Japanese will make a pilgrimage to a spa at least once a year if they can afford it. Of course, massage is also, I mean, a lot of people work massage in hot springs because it also releases a lot of the muscles. This is a Balinese hot spring where massage is a very common treatment. And of course, underground, there is all this fantastic water. And a lot of it is very high in calcium, it's very high in minerals. Some of it's been under the ground for millions of years. And so when it rises, people gather and people put down springs and bores or wells to get... This is Daylesford in Victoria, which is probably the most interesting water area in Australia because there are something like 50 or 60 different springs. And each one of these springs in Daylesford has a different chemical consistency, a different physical consistency. And this is very unusual. They're all cold water, but, you know, that they vary in the amount of calcium or magnesium or whatever sort of minerals that they have. And so lots of people go there to sample them. And it's a fabulous reserve. And I think children that I met there were much, much more conscious of the differences. It was just by going around tasting all the differences, by the way. And Canberra's water could do with improvement. Talking about taste, yes, anyway. Japan. This is that water of knowledge that I told you about. They, about 600 years ago, a Japanese priest discovered this spring and he had a dream that he was to build a temple there. And now there's this enormous temple complex, but the spring still pours out of a mountain. It's actually a waterfall, but it's been hived off into these channels. And the Japanese have this very clever and way of disinfection. They use these really long spoons on long sticks that are UV disinfected, and everyone lines up to help themselves. And so schools are particularly visitors. I mean, there were at least 16 busloads of school children within the first couple of hours that I was there, and they all queue for the water of knowledge. One of the other things that water does, by the way, is it expresses itself by movement. Water does not run straight naturally. When you think of the laws of physics, it basically should. If water runs downhill, it should just run straight downhill, but it doesn't. If you look at aerial photographs of rivers, you'll see this looping pattern. And this looping form of water is the way that primitive people and early cultures indicated water. They drew it like that, and that's where the letter W comes from. It comes from the form of water itself. And the other thing that water does is it moves in spirals. Water, if you look at water running on a... I mean, if we want to develop a relationship with water, you have to actually sit beside it for a while. Sit beside it and just look at it, just study it. Don't necessarily interfere with or let yourself go with the water and watch it move, watch its form, and you'll see that even the fastest river is moving in spirals. And of course the greatest expression of that spiral is the whirlpool. The most dangerous expression of that spiral is the whirlpool. But that spiral expresses itself constantly in nature. In all the forms of nature you see the spiral. In plants, in animals, sometimes even in shells. You know, like this is the perfect example, for instance, of the spiral form in nature expressed by the magic of water. Because what happened? That little dot in the middle, that little tiny dot from which this shell emerged, had the prototype of this form already contained within it. just as I suggest that the original sea had the prototype of all life contained within it. I mean, this shell produced a geometry that's influenced architects and mathematicians for thousands of years. And of course, when we look up in the sky, we see clouds forming spirals. They form hurricanes, form spirals, of course, but even cloud forms form spirals. And this is the top of the human head. This is a friend of mine. I just happened to be looking down on the top of his head, and I could see that humans, too, a spiral on the top. You wouldn't necessarily realise that we too, have a spiral contained in our genes. But the great hurricanes, of course, are the great expression of the spiral. But if we go further, if we go out into the universe, we will see the spiral nebula. We'll see the signature of water in the universe if we look hard enough. And we'll see the signature of water in our DNA. And so from the smallest form to the greatest energy, the spiral form of water and the spiral energy of water manifests itself. And so that's the message that this drop brings to us. This is the message of water to me. Is the majesty of creation and the minuscule capacity of this small drop to sustain us. Thank you. Any questions? And I don't know how we're running for time, but...
Sorry. Yeah, thank you for a wonderful talk. I wonder if you've been to the Blue Lagoon in Iceland, and if you have, what your impressions were of that water.
Sorry, I can't hear. Yeah.
The Blue Lagoon in Iceland.
The Blue Lagoon in Iceland.
Yes, I wonder if you've been there and what your impressions were.
No. No, I haven't been to the Blue... I've mainly... My travels have been limited, basically, because that's my field of interest to Asia, to Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands. And so I have never travelled to Europe. I've never travelled beyond India. I don't know why. I suppose the reason for that is that I'm much more focused on indigenous ideas about water and also Asian religious rituals and Asian beliefs about water, because they've survived. In Europe, all that stuff has gone through a period of, if you like, Christianisation, a period during which the rituals and ideas of water worship were denigrated and diminished and in many cases disappeared, and there's only vestiges. Whereas in Asia, the idea that water's a holy thing, that rivers are holy, that water, rain is holy, the idea that, for instance, priests can bring rain. You know, we during the drought, I remember seeing a photograph, sorry, this is off the subject of the Blue Lagoon, I remember seeing a photograph of a priest in a country newspaper, a photograph of a priest praying for rain. And I wondered who he was praying to, you know, like I wondered do we expect that there's someone up there who's going to rearrange the clouds, who is going to make rain happen? There are, for instance, priests in Tibet, Buddhist priests, who one of whom accompanies the Dalai Lama on his trips. His job is to stop the rain if the Dalai Lama is speaking outside and start the rain when he leaves. And this guy has been, he's died recently, but he's called the Rainmaker, right? Now, the Australian Aborigines have a great tradition of rainmaking, but they don't make rain because they have a drought. They make rain for ritual purposes. They make rain because it's part of a ritual that they go through. So you can't just call up a guy and say, we're in drought, can you come and make a big rain? But this is what we expect of a Christian God, that basically he'll help us out. But in actual fact, indigenous people and the practices and rituals of indigenous people seem to have far more effect on the weather, seem to have far more effect on those clouds up there that are so mysterious, and we don't understand where they come from or what they do or what they mean. In Tibet, there's a book of clouds. In one of the monasteries in Tibet, there's a book of clouds that came from China 1,200 years ago. And that's cloud interpretation. It's because they believe, somebody out there believed that God, the gods, write in cloud forms in the sky. And then you You could decipher these forms. You could have a book whereby you could take the cloud form and decipher its meaning. And there are still religious groups, Buddhist groups, and there's one on the Central Coast near where I live who bought a mountain and they're building a temple on the mountain. And what they do is study the clouds. Their religious discipline is to lie on their back and study the sky. And they you need to try this sometime. If you lie on your back and study the clouds for a while, mostly kids do it. You know, kids have all the fun. When we were kids, we used to lie down and study the clouds, and the clouds would make all these forms, and we'd tell each other what we were seeing up there. But if you simply lie down and let the essence of those forms move you, you will find that you drift off into another place, and that's the place where water wants to take us. That's the place that's holy to me. That's where I go sometimes if I'm lucky. Sorry, I got off the Blue Lagoon.
No, thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you for your fascinating talk. In our secular society in Australia, you know, we're...
I'm going to come down. I'm sorry. I have a slight hearing problem, so I've been getting out of the flute.
In our secular society in Australia, you know, we are beach lovers. But I just wonder why intuitively when we go to the beach and settle down with our towels, we always face the sea. Nobody ever goes to the beach and then, you know, turns their back to the sea. We always look at the sea. Have you got any comments about that?
A lot of comments, I think. But I think that you know, essentially, again, what moves us, what soothes us, what calms us is repetition of movement. And what we're seeing in the sea is the spiral movement of the waves. I mean, waves are spiral. Look at a wave, you know, it's a perfect spiral. And so we're constantly calmed, I think, by this repetition of movement, by the vastness of this ocean that many people believe to be the repository of the memory of the universe, you know, that this... Like we're coming to that, we're coming close to it. We have to realise that we are water. What do we think with? You know, what do we see with? Our brains are 80% water in a grey membrane. Scientists tell us that every 48 hours that water moves through us and goes somewhere else. So we're constantly having new water passing through our brains. And this is what we're thinking with. This is why people had the idea that water contained the memory of everything that ever was, because it's been everywhere. It's been in every tree and every rock and every animal, and it's everywhere. You know, we constantly, if we try and describe what we think of as a deity, if we try and describe what God is, we think, well, God is everywhere. God created the world. God is up there in the sky. You know, how many religions believe that God is up there in the sky? But what is up there in the sky really is water, you know, and what created the world really was water, and what unites us all is water. And if you took the water away from this entire thing, it would just turn to dust, because that's the only thing that holds all the atoms and molecules that make up the carpet and the concrete and the rock and the stone and us. And so, you know, I used to be apologetic about the idea of thinking that water might be God, but as I got closer to meeting God, I decided I was probably right. It suited me anyway. So I think why we go to the sea is that we're meeting the mother again. We're meeting the analysis of our blood, composition of our blood is very, very similar to the composition of the sea. So it's worthwhile to imagine that we're going back. And if we ritualise that, even in our own mind, we don't have to produce all sorts of elaborate rituals. But I think if we inculcate some of that into our children, some of that reverence, because without that, what science has done is robbed us of reverence. You know, I'm a critic of science in many respects, because I think in attempting to demystify the world, they have robbed us and robbed our children. And fortunately, my childhood never got robbed. I didn't grow up in a family of scientists. I grew up in a family of people who believed in Norse myths and crazy stories about bunyips. And I hung around in, you know, camps with indigenous people who told me stories about monsters. And so I admit that I'm biased. I grew up biased. But what I'm saying when I talk to children today who talk about science has taken away, if you like, that the idea that there is a mystery there, or if there is a mystery, we're going to solve it. And God is not a mystery to be solved. Deities are not mysteries to be solved. Their nature, if you think of nature as a deity, is to be approached with reverence. Its reverence is our appropriate response to the sacred. And I think that many scientists, are on a wrong track in denigrating, like Richard Dawkins and people like that, are on a wrong track in denigrating this completely. Yes, there are faults with all religions. Yes, there are faults with all those sorts of people and ideas that seek to control. But nature itself and those indigenous cultures that have worshipped nature for thousands of years, they're the ones that kept the earth. They're the ones that looked after the earth. And they're the ones that I think we ought to be going back to for inspiration. Sorry, yes.
Have you drunk from the fountain of youth? And what's the magic element?
It's because the microphone vibrates a bit, but if you don't mind.
Have you drunk from the fountain of youth? And what's the special factor in that fountain?
You know, because the fountain of youth is something that did obsess me for a while. And there are places in the world that have reputedly, not so much the fountain of youth, but the capacity to allow people to extend their lifespan to some considerable space. There is a community in South America, there's a community in the Caucasus that live to extraordinary lengths, like 150 years, 140 years, getting remarried at 120, you know, because they feel like they want to have some more kids. These people drink from specific springs, but also their diet and lifestyle. I mean, it's very hard to separate the idea that the diet, lifestyle and water, what contributes to this longevity. But it has certainly been established that the water they drink is extraordinarily pure and contains unusual levels of different minerals in different combinations. There are fabulous paintings of the water, the Fountain of Youth. In medieval times, it was a particularly favourite motif of quite a lot of painters and engravers. And the hope was that one could do it. And people thought that the Ganges water, Alexander the Great believed in the Fountain of Youth, and he had heard about the Ganges. He'd heard about this magic spring that poured out of a mountain in the Himalayas. And he was struggling to get there. That was his great push eastward, was to get to the magic spring. And he died at 33 without making it. But I think the story of the Fountain of Youth, much of it came from the myth of the Ganges and the whole story of that. And when that cut back to Europe in the 12th, 13th, 14th century, I mean, a lot of that stuff came to Europe very early through the trade routes, and these stories of a magic spring that would restore life. No, I haven't drunk it, but what I do drink every day is a little spring that in the forest behind me, not very far from where I live on the Central Coast, and it pours into a great big pool, and that's where I bathe every day, and that's where I go to think. And it's over that my 20-year relationship with this spring and this water that has energised my life and given me the inspiration and the space and allowed me to express myself in support of water's deification.
I can tell you that I have had a drink from it.
Ah!
One of them, in America, of course.
So you're going to say that you're 160?
In Florida, near Fort Lauderdale. And also, so did my parents, who are 97 and 93 at the present time. And however, I'm always interested in the concept of that. And homeopathy is one factor, if you could give us a few of your ideas about. And the other thing is those water energizing gadgets that people have that make the water go like this down.
Okay.
Do they
things.
Work?
Fort Lauderdale I know about. Because the North American Indians believe that this spring was extraordinary. And it is extraordinary. It's a fountain of life, but not one you necessarily want to experience in its fullest extent, because what happens at the bottom of that spring, there's no dissolved oxygen. At the bottom of that water, there's no dissolved oxygen. So down there, they found whole bodies of saber-toothed tigers, whole structure, because they haven't deteriorated. They've remained, in a sense, they're still dead, but they're still there. And so whether the North American Indians actually knew that this spring had this incredible capacity to preserve, because what they've got out of that spring is quite extraordinary. And I know that people have serious beliefs about it. What was the second question? I know the third one was about gadgets.
On that point, if you don't...
Homeopathy.
My father also had some charge over the Ganges Canal back in the end of the Second World War, which might also contribute to his old age.
Yes.
But the second question is homeopathy.
Homeopathy. I think homeopathy's the idea of homeopathy, the idea that a tiny, tiny proportion of something when added to water can have medicinal qualities, positive medicinal qualities, which is the fundamental principle of homeopathy. I don't know. I don't know. I have used it on time to from time to time. I can't say, but I know I was fascinated by Bach's idea, Bach flower remedies, which are an offshoot of homeopathy, because I know that Bach was a conventional doctor who felt that he wasn't working well within medicine, that his practice wasn't working, that he wasn't helping people, and he went to some isolated village in Wales, and he, walking across a dew-covered field one day, he got the idea that the dew was infused with the energy of the flowers, the dew was infused with the energy of the grass, and that the combination of the sun, the dew, and the flowers produced an essence. And he tried these essences on himself, and he started prescribing them. If you read the story of the Bach flowers, well, Bach's sort of transformation from a Western medical doctor into a homeopath, it's quite a fascinating story. And you know, he went on to become extraordinarily successful in his treatments. So I do think that there's a great deal to be said for that. The other thing that I would like to say is that Leanne tells me there's going to be a debate about recycled water shortly. And one of the things I'd like you to remember about recycled water is its homeopathic principles. The idea of homeopathy is that the water remembers where it's been. The water carries the memory of the flowers and how it's been, how the sun came and infused it. And so the tiniest drop of that water in quite a large, tiniest drop of that infused dew in a large volume of water gives it highly powerful medicinal qualities. If you reverse that and think, well, you know, the water that comes out of sewage treatment plants might smell okay by the time you've treated it, it might look okay, it might be clear, but it carries the memory of where it's been, and this is why I believe that recycled water is not going to work for us in a health context. It might work for us in a resource context. So the third thing was about, and relating to what I've just said about recycled water, one of the ways in which some people recycle sewage water that seems to have enormous potential is movement. But like you know, why water does long loops instead of going straight is that water oxygenates itself and purifies itself by movement. So the longer and the further it can move, the purer it'll be. And so on that principle, in Scandinavian countries, some in Sweden and some in Denmark, they start to experiment with the idea of purifying water by movement alone and using a wetland at the end of that. And California got into that. There was an outfit an idea called Flowforms. And flowforms were simply an artificial way of duplicating water's preferred sense of movement so that you could create these forms that would move water through this. And they found that water sheds a lot of its toxic material, a lot of its toxic load, because it absorbs a lot of oxygen in that movement. That's a sign. I don't necessarily go with a scientific explanation, but that's what happens. So in essence, then, in answer to your question, I think that even in India, when they say water has lost its chi, it's lost its energy, it's lost its life energy, how they restore that is, if you ever saw that film called Cocktail, where Tom Cruise pours cocktails like that from one glass into another from a 2 foot or 3 foot height, that's how they re-energise their water. They regard that. And that's, of course, oxygenating. That's taking it. They do that 5-10 times. And they regard that as, they call it prana, they don't call it chi. Chi is an oriental version of the energy, the life energy. So they're saying water can not lose its life energy, because water is indestructible. That's the other godlike thing about water, is that it's indestructible. And we can't do anything to it, because even if we pollute it, it simply purifies itself by rising into the sky and becoming clouds and becoming rain, leaves us with the toxins and comes back. So the water cycle is constantly moving and constantly purifying itself through movement. So I've never analysed these devices, but the principle I think is okay. I couldn't speak for any products.
In my taste testing of desal water, the significant factor to me is it tastes dead.
Yes.
Lifeless.
Yes. Well, I mean, let's face it, all water is dead by the time it gets to your tap, because it's passed through, like in the case of Sydney, 25,000 k's of pipe. If you've ever looked at a water main, the smell is unbelievable. People evacuate areas sometimes because the smell is just so bad. So it's passing through these pipes through which algae and debris and muck have built up over years and years and years. And for instance, in the case of Sydney, it would take 200 years of daily working to replace those pipes, because they're all under our cities. And so water authorities don't like to think about that. The easiest way to do that is to put more chlorine in, put more junk in, because they know that by the time it gets to the other end, it's already absorbed a lot of toxins. But, you know, current experiments with water have shown that essentially water doesn't want to travel along straight pipes. It wants to move. If you allow it to move like that, it'll be pure. If you constrain it within thousands of kilometres of straight polluted pipe, it's not likely to be too good when it comes out the other end. And that's in fact why, you know, it's unfortunate that people prefer bottled water to tap water. But, you know, you can have a free tap here and a guy selling bottled water there, and I tell you, this guy will make a fortune. Because people actually intuitively know. And if you try and feed a dog tap water versus rainwater or creek water, you'll find that the dog will prefer creek water. Try it. If you've got a pet, lock the pet up with some tap water and some other water, and just watch what the pet chooses, because animals are much cleverer than us. We've lost our confidence in our sense of smell, in our sense of what's dangerous. We've got scientists to tell us that this water is pure, you can drink it with it, no problem, it'll be all right. It's not. I don't believe it, personally.
Can I have one last question? I read your book, The 21st Century. I'm very stroppy about trying to get people to go easy on the water. All I get is resentment and anger in return. Have you got any handy hints on how to persuade people to respect and water, love water better?
After 20 years, I've kind of retired from trying to change people's minds, because one of the great Roman thinkers said, you know, against stupidity even the gods struggle in vain. So I think that you know, if people are not going to listen to this, so I turned to the spiritual. You know, I thought, I'm getting old. You know, I've been fighting for the idea of a different attitude to water in that sort of context for a long while, and now it's, I think for me, it's time to look at the spiritual side of water and encourage people to look at that, because I do think that. Essentially, our planet is becoming incredibly overpopulated, and you can see this wherever you go. And I think that we're approaching a time when a tipping point when we can't change. And I don't know if we can change, but people don't want to change, and that's the sad thing. But I can't be sad about that. I think that we have to allow people to choose. And another Roman philosopher said that the gods we choose determine our destiny. So I think it's kind of interesting that thousands of people are queued up across the lake to see some old French guy's paintings. And we're just here, this little group. But it shows where our society's priorities are. You know, it shows what we're really about. And I think that it shows in many respects. We see that demonstrated daily, that people will choose perhaps what's not in their best interests, but I don't know where that leads us. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer to that one.
Just about the spirituality of our country here, I wonder if you have any reflections about the Artesian Basin and the water within our country, but also any particular references or understandings you have about the Indigenous relationship to water.
Because, you know, it's commonplace these days for politicians and environmentalists and scientists to pay lip service to the Indigenous people of this country and the way that they treated the environment and the way that they treated water and look to them for inspiration as to how we might change. I mean, really, you know, seriously, I mean, if we wanted to live like Indigenous people lived, if we wanted to embrace the lifestyle of Indigenous people, then we would closely understand our relationships with nature, the environment and water. But we don't want to do that. We want to stay in our suburbs and kind of feel some sort of, or imagine that Indigenous people have some secret knowledge that they're prepared to impart to us. I have worked with Indigenous people in Central Australia for some time, and I was sort of deeply impressed by their silence, by the fact that they... And one old man said to me, you know, you people won't be here for long. You came a couple of hundred years ago and you're going to go and we'll still be here because we know how to survive in this environment. And essentially, look at you, you're just basically killing yourselves. And this was quite a while ago. This is about, I don't know, 25 years ago. So the Indigenous perspective of our occupation of the land is quite an interesting one. But, you know, they revered water. They had water deities. The whole of the iconography of Aboriginal Australia is full of fabulous water stories and water deities. And of course, they recognised the value of what water meant to them, of how water underwrote their lives and their lifestyle. But they don't see us recognising that at all. Well, they just see us playing sort of games about embracing various aspects of Indigenous belief. And that's really not going to help us at all. Because, you know, here we are sitting here, and we're not sitting out by the lake around a fire. We're not actually communicating with water in the way that we might be if we were Indigenous people. Because if you went to any Indigenous people in the world and talked to them about water, they would take you out there. They would sit you in it. They'd put you under a waterfall. They'd put you in a canoe. They'd throw you over the Niagara Falls. Whatever it was that they did, you would have an experience, you know. And we become passive. We become passive observers of other people's experiences. And I think that, you know, this is the relationship that we've developed with Indigenous knowledge, that we passively view this, but we don't actually do anything really about it. In relation to our own water supply, I think that, you know, the problem with our world, the problem with Canberra, the problem with Sydney, the problem with Australia, the problem with America, the problem with our civilization is that we've allowed corporate governance to dominate and corporate values and the idea of globalization, the idea of money, the idea of power and control to dominate our thinking. And none of that is going to cut any ice with Indigenous values. None of that does our water supply any good. At the moment, we have people wanting to dig holes under Sydney's catchments, you know, for mining. And we're having a debate about that. There should be no debate about that. You don't dig holes under your lifeline. We're having a debate about whether or not some big mining company shall be able to withdraw all this water from the Artesian Basin because they want to mine for something or other, and that water will be returned to nature in a highly polluted state that will seep down and poison the basin in the end anyway. And we're debating that, you know. The fact that we're debating that, or even just sort of says something on its own. I don't think we should be debating that. I think we should be just simply throwing that stuff out. But the fact is, our politicians and our scientists and even some of our environmentalists are going along with this because the status quo, you know, what can you do? It's progress, you know. Well, progress has got a road and the road has an end and we're moving down that road, and how far and how fast is up to us, really. I'll come up. Sorry, the microphone isn't working for me.
That's what I mean. I've really enjoyed your talk. And since I've come to live in Canberra, I've noticed a trend of people throwing shopping trolleys into the lake. And I can't get my head around that. Have you got any ideas?
Yeah. I see shopping trolleys. I live on the Central Coast and people throw shopping trolleys in canals. You know, shopping trolleys are... I think of it as a sign of contempt. But what's contempt? Contempt is about frustration. It's about not understanding your place in the world. It's about not knowing, you know, And much as we might get angry and distressed about this, you know, the only way that that's going to change and the only way we can teach our children is by bringing them into proximity with nature, by teaching them respect for nature. And we don't teach them respect for nature by giving them books or DVDs or videos or taking them anywhere. We do it by sitting with them. We do it by being with them. We do it with our attitude. Transmits itself to our children. And so those shopping trolleys that we see in the lake do mean something. They're messages. They're messages from our world back to us. Water again reflecting us. I love sitting beside the lake. I sat beside the lake and talked to some black swans. I haven't seen any... Sorry, I'm fiddling with my microphone. I haven't seen any black swans for a while. And just coming back from lunch yesterday, to sit beside the lake and watch the reflections and the sounds of the swans, you know, it's, we go to concerts to listen to music, you know, and when we go to concerts to listen to music, to some great violinist or cellist or orchestra or folk singer or whatever, you know, we sit there with our ears open because we're listening for the music. When we go into nature, we don't hear it because we don't listen. We don't listen with the same ears that we go to concert halls to. And I suppose over time, my relationship with the forest has taught me to listen. It just taught me how to hear. And that's another thing that we learn from being silent, you know, from our silences. And one of the sad things about, you know, the way that science is teaching children to relate to nature is that they were doing things. So, you know, good, you catch a lot of little fish, or you check the water for bacteria, or you see whether it's eroding the banks of the river. It's all doing. But if you really want a relationship with water, it's about being. It's about stillness. It's about going to the water in humility and reverence and sitting there and seeing what happens. And believe me, things happen. That's all I can say.
I used to live near you at Brooklyn on the river. And drive the water taxi.
I'm still there.
Yep. Anyway, bus loads, train loads of children used to come along. The railway track is right near the water. I'd be waiting there and I'd watch every child chuck 10 rocks in the river, and on the few occasions when I tried to stop them, persuade them, interest them in the idea that that's land erosion and siltation of the river, I got looked at and told that I was the most boring person on earth, which without a doubt I was at the time, but that big ferry can't float there any longer at low tide. And all across this town, I'm a professional skipper. When I see people chucking rocks in the water, I get upset and occasionally talk to them about it. You got any better ideas how to stop them doing it? Because that's the beginning of shopping trolleys in the water. The water's our ultimate garbage dump, where things just disappear, unless you're a scuba diver or a snorkeler. And we're treating the ocean in the same way. And everybody's fussing about how much carbon dioxide there's in the atmosphere, a dim awareness of the Gaia in the middle of the Pacific. But other than that, just keep tipping that stuff in the ocean. And at the risk of getting really boring, I used to be the master of Karma. Karma was a sailboat, and we went to Harvey Bay, and we had a special permit to anchor in the middle, sleep on the deck with a microphone underwater. And I've come here especially to tell you that the whales and the dolphins told me that they cannot stand the taste of detergent and photographic chemicals. It stings their eyes and makes the water taste nasty. And I'm just hoping in the future the awareness of what we do to the oceans will have more priority in our minds.
It's nice to... I hope so. That's all I can say. I hope so. The history of humankind, particularly the last couple of hundred years in Western society, doesn't give me a great deal of optimism. You know, I mean, those kids are products of our education system. They're products of our families. They're products of the way that society looks at the world. They're products of the way that we view nature. And you can't undo that in one simple movement. It's not like that, you know. And yeah, I'm at a loss on that one.
I'm a great tea drinker, a tea connoisseur.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
It's the vibration of the microphone. So
yeah.
It doesn't work for me.
Sorry? Oh, sorry. That's better, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm a great tea drinker, a tea connoisseur, and I just wanted to raise Japanese tea ceremonies and, you know, the role of water in that ritual. But also I recall as a child back in Adelaide in the 50s, you know, I had to do a course called Home Science, and we spent a whole session learning how to prepare the perfect cup of pot of tea. And one of the rules was that you must use freshly boiled water. And I think it was Adelaide water was very brown coloured in those days.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So I think we were instructed that, you know, where we had access to it, rainwater was preferable to tap water as well. But I just wonder whether, and, you know, ladies used to have afternoon teas and bring out their best cup, saucers, and plates, and have cucumber sandwiches and play cards, you know, all hovering around, you know, beautiful teapots and crockery. And I just wondered whether, you know, you could talk a little bit about, you know, the role of water in that tea ritual, which has now passed us by, because now it's all tea bags, isn't it, in our sort of
Absolutely.
Hurried life.
I get terribly offended when I go into a restaurant or a coffee shop and I ask for a pot of tea and I get a pot of unfiltered boiled water with a tea bag floating in it. I've been forgetting. I'm under the influence of tea. The tea is my drug of choice, so to speak. And so Margaret, who's here, Margaret travels a lot in China, and we've travelled a lot to Japan and Asia, and we've drunk tea, many, many teas. We collect teas. And so... The history of tea is also fascinating to me. Unfortunately, the British legacy in the British tea ceremony is probably the least helpful in terms of health, in terms of quality. Like, the Chinese emperors had cellars of waters for different teas that came from different springs. This is how they were like wine, and they would store these in jars. And when their tea masters would make a tea of a particular quality that came from that particular area, they would choose a water that would blend with it. Now, that's how fine you can get with tea, but you don't have milk and you don't have sugar. And essentially, you like this green tea that I'm drinking now has to be made at 80 degrees. You don't put boiling water on green tea because you kill everything to do with it. You kill its vitamin C, but knowing that, you destroy its scent. So 80 degrees, you have if you want to make tea at 80 degrees, by the way, I found using a thermometer that all you need to do is pour boiling water into an ordinary teapot and then pour that into your next teapot, into your green teapot, and you'll get that will be almost exactly at 80 degrees. So the Chinese and the Japanese, and the Chinese taught the Japanese after all, so the Chinese are the source, if you like, of what we know about tea. And essentially, the tea that the British drink and the tea that the Australians liked, which is, you know, black tea, that's the lowest quality tea on the whole that you can get. You know, that's not really... It's like if you drink a really the greatest wine, the best champagne you could find, and you go back and buy a $7 bottle of some bubbly somewhere, you compare these two things. This is the comparison of some green teas and black tea. And they're very expensive. They're you know, run up to $500 and $600 a kilo, maybe more, maybe $1,000 a kilo, some of them. So you're talking, when you're talking gourmet teas, you're talking another quality, another sense of taste, another style, another thought. So I've abandoned. I grew up in a country property, and you know, we grew up around morning and afternoon teas, and the tea sets, and the cakes, and the milk, and my father always had 4 teaspoons of sugar because he was a patriotic Queenslander. And I have diabetes, and so did he. So it was fatal for him. So some tea ceremonies cannot work very well for you at all. Whereas, you know, if you... Green tea, a fine quality green tea made at 80 degrees with no other additives is a really enhancing drink. It will... inspire you, it will make you excitable, it can make you converse a bit more than you might normally. I have one tea which it says on the label, you know, this tea promotes familiar chatting talks, you know, and if you give it to someone who's terribly shy and they have for two or three cups, they're telling you their life story, you know, after a little while. And sometimes you don't even want to hear this, but I'm just saying there are teas of different qualities. Once you start to learn more about tea, and there are plenty of books about it, it's an amazing story. And the great tea ceremony, we've done tea ceremonies with Japanese people in Japan too, and that's a great ritual. But that tea that they use for the tea ceremony is a very fine powdered tea, which is incredibly powerful, and it gives you a lot of energy. But it directs it in a way that coffee doesn't. For instance, I gave up coffee because that tea... They used to meditate. That tea was designed for monks. It was designed so that a monk could sit cross-legged and stare at a wall for a day without moving, but his mind could stay centred. What that particular tea does is centre the mind. So when we started to play tennis, we used to use this tea in breaks when we were playing tennis, and we found our tennis improved to the extent that the people playing opposite us wanted the same tea so they could have an equal handicap. But, you know, I think there are some teas that will do extraordinary things for you in very subtle ways. And the Japanese tea ceremony was originally a monastic ceremony to enhance the meditation of monks and to improve their capacity for centering their minds. That's a quality you don't find in tea bag full of modern tea. Even Tetley's can't claim that.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.